This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Where is Richard Simmons? A new podcast seeks to find the energetic fitness guru who vanished from the public eye 3 years ago. And we're going to listen back to our 2005 conversation with Simmons later in this very program. But first, what's going on at the old Eastland Mall site? Better question, why is nothing going on? Eastland Mall was once a thriving center of commerce on the city's east side, and then it fell into hard times, closed, became a derelict building. So the city bought the site and tore down the mall. Several proposals have been entertained, including a Hollywood-style movie studio and a Latin-themed market, but nothing panned out. Aside from a portion of the land that was sold to Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, it is still an enormous vacant lot. Well, now Charlotte City Council wants a new plan to redevelop the site. The Economic Development Committee recommended hiring a team of consultants to devise such a plan to attract developers. That could cost as much as $575,000, and full City Council is expected to vote on a contract on March 27th. Back in October, we spoke with some of the people involved, and today we'll hear part of that discussion about what seems to be the holdup for new development. We spoke with Astrid Chirinos from the Latin American Economic Development Corporation, Mary Newsom from UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, and Pat Mumford, Director of Neighborhood and Business Services for the City of Charlotte. Pat, let me begin with you. When the city bought the Eastland Mall property, if I'm not mistaken, the hope was that it could quickly sell this land to a developer and new business would grow and act as a catalyst for the area. Given all of the growth elsewhere around Charlotte, why hasn't that happened?
Well, first and foremost, the city council chose to purchase that to stop the blight that was occurring. It was about 1.2 million square feet of space that was literally just dilapidating and getting worse day by day. Mm-hmm. So I applaud the council for that action. I think if that had not occurred and those facilities still existed on that site, what sort of mess we'd have right now. So that was a positive. To then also approve demolishing the mall was positive. So now we have this blank slate. Would we have rather had somebody come in and purchase the entire parcel and redevelop it immediately? Absolutely. What we've learned over the years is that was probably not a realistic expectation.
Why not? Given the fact that other areas like South End, that was a blighted area before the train came through and then all these apartments sprung up. You have NoDa, which is a quickly being redeveloped, which has been an artsy area but not a high-income area. Why not the east side?
Well, the two areas that you mentioned, South End and NoDa, have market characteristics that are vastly different than those characteristics around the Eastland Mall, old Eastland Mall site. Uh-huh. The demographics are different. The disposable income is different. It's a different market. And that's what we have to respect and understand, that thinking this is going to turn around like a South End, again, is not a realistic expectation.
So developers know that the city is not in the development business and that the city doesn't want to own this big, hulking 70-acre piece of property. Is that hurting you? Because these developers are now looking for a deal because they know you want to unload this white elephant?
No, I think it actually helps because the city has done the hard work of assembling that property. The city bought that as an assemblage. Prior to that, there were 9 owners.
Okay.
With a lot of different restrictions given them all. So So that's very positive from a development standpoint. So an entity, or as we think, multiple entities can come in once we have our plan developed and have some certainty about what will occur around them and give context to that development, because the city now has the ability to control and influence what is now 69 acres remaining.
Let's go back and talk about that Eastland Mall area. Mary Newsom, in the 80s, that mall was thriving. It was the place to shop. It was not South Park. It was Eastland Mall. And the area around it seemed to be pretty stable at the time. What happened?
A lot of things happened. The and a lot of them were not related to each other. One of them was that the housing policies changed in the city. All over the country, people started using vouchers for housing instead of public housing. And a lot of those vouchers ended up in West Charlotte and East Charlotte, which means that there was a lot more people of low income living in those neighborhoods, starting in the 80s and the 90s. Another thing is that malls just kind of became a tired concept. There's virtually no enclosed shopping malls being built in the U.S. today. Pat may know. I don't think any of them are being built. Mm. Another thing that happened is that the sort of speedy suburbia that went out in that area in the 80s got old. You know, it's cheap buildings, single story, surrounded by asphalt. It's really hard to retrofit. Mm. You talked about South End and NoDa. Those neighborhoods have what urban designers call good bones, which means they've got a good block structure. They can be made walkable very easily. They can be urban very easily. Eastland Mall area, it's suburbia. It does not have those good bones.
Astrid Chirinos is also here. She is the chief development executive with the Latin American Economic Development Corporation. The ethnic makeup of the East Side, particularly around that mall, has changed dramatically since the 1970s, 1980s. There's been a considerable increase in the Hispanic population around that area. Is that why you're involved in this?
Very much so. The Eastland site is one of the last urban sites that we can have to develop as a center of opportunities. The demographics in the East Corridors changed dramatically. It's not only that you have Latinos, but you have Asians, African-Americans, people from all over the world, the Middle East. There are 125 languages spoken there. It's the most entrepreneurial corridor that we have in Charlotte as well. It's the most immigrant. And it is one that has not been really looked at in its current reality, and we're trying to impose models and ideas of other times, and instead of really looking at what is happening there and the economic opportunity and social innovation hub that it can be.
Well, quickly give me the lay of the land. What's around it? If you are successful in redeveloping in into something that is both aesthetically pleasing, usable by people in the neighborhood, and an economic engine for the area, what's around it? Is it primarily single-family homes, neighborhoods, apartments? Is it small businesses, garages? What is it?
It's all of the above. But they are all disconnected. And that's what is happening there, that all the assets in the corridor don't really have a connectivity platform to really be able to develop the whole corridor as it happened in the south or as it's happening in the north or west.
Now, you have been meeting with investors. Are these people, are these the kind of people who will be likely to take portions of this 70-acre site or 69-acre site? Or are they interested in taking the whole thing and doing something with it?
All of the above. They are interested in creating a hub of opportunities there and be able to bring entrepreneurial development, business incubators, accelerators, hospitality, retail, housing, everything that is necessary at this point to be able to support the opportunities in there. So the equity partners are have been talking to us. We've also talked to the city as well. And they want to have at least an idea of when the city is ready to move forward. And that's why we've been talking to Pat and the whole team there.
Are you ready?
Sure. I'm just sitting here behaving.
Is the city ready to move forward? It would seem to me you'd be...
City is ready.
The horse is saddled and ready to go, isn't it?
Well, we've identified the horse. Okay. We haven't put the saddle on the horse yet.
All right.
So if I might just back up for a quick second.
Sure.
We talked about bones and lack of bones in this area, and I don't want listeners to think that all is lost on the East Side. The East Side has a great sense of pride, not only of the history of that area. They want a sense of place to come back to that site, as does the city. I think the bones piece, if you look in those neighborhoods that surround this site, there's a quality stock of housing, housing that was built 50s, 60s, 70s, so brick, well-built homes that are attractive to young families that might want to come back into that area.
With big yards.
With big yards, that's correct. And so an interesting parallel to the South End conversation, South End is a mile from downtown. This site is 5 miles.
Okay.
That doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a big difference in development patterns.
Okay.
So as Mary mentioned, the pattern out in that area is more suburban in nature than urban. But the urban aspect is coming out Central Avenue from the area about 2 miles from downtown, and it's going to jump eastway and be out to this site soon enough. There is an investment that is proposed for the Gold Line streetcar to continue out and terminate at this site.
Mm-hmm.
And so ultimately, this one site of 80 acres doesn't solve all of these issues, but it begins to shift and change the dynamic. And so that's what the city's looking for. We're looking to have something that can send a message to this community that the tide is turning, mm-hmm. and that redevelopment will start here and hopefully positively influence redevelopment in these corridors we mentioned, primarily Central and Albemarle, and then influence positively the neighborhoods that surround this area. It's going to take time.
And you, the city, has put together a request from consultants to draw up a new master plan for that site. Do you have any druthers about what you'd like to see included in a master plan for that site? Any vision whatsoever for that site?
Well, we do have a vision. The vision was actually established by the community 7 or 8 years ago. We're sticking to those principles to help recreate this space. It will be a mix of uses, including open space, residential, and some commercial that will support it. It will not be a mall again. The market won't support that.
That's Pat Mumford, Director of Neighborhood and Business Services for the City of Charlotte. We also spoke with Astrid Chirinos with the Latin American Economic Development Corporation and Mary Newsom from UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. Our conversation originally aired late last year. The city is seeking a new plan to redevelop the Eastland Mall site, and the city council is scheduled to vote on a contract to hire a team of consultants on March 27th. When we come back, where's Richard Simmons? A new podcast says the spotlight-loving fitness guru has been missing in action since 2014. More in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Is Richard Simmons missing? The effervescent fitness guru is well known as much for his enthusiastic and sometimes eccentric personality as he is for his sweating to the oldies aerobics videos. But in February 2014, Simmons seems to have disappeared from the public eye. The mystery has spawned a popular podcast, Missing Richard Simmons.
This is the Richard Simmons you know.
I want to see 25 of these, 10, 10, and 5. And we're going to do it together, and we're going to burn some calories.
Or maybe this is.
Welcome back to the show, Richard. How are you doing?
Thank you so much, David Letterman.
Or maybe this is.
Hi!
But on February 15th, 2014, Richard Simmons stopped being Richard Simmons.
Where is Richard?
I have no idea.
All of a sudden, nothing.
He straight up got up and disappeared.
He hasn't been seen in public since. And ghosted absolutely everyone he knew. I know, because I'm one of them. I'm Dan Taberski. This podcast is Missing Richard Simmons. And on it, I'm trying to find out what happened to Richard.
Richard Simmons runs on human interaction. That has been his modus operandi for decades. If he's not doing that, then something is going on for him.
I'm not trying to just blow smoke. He saved a lot of people's lives.
This wasn't just I don't want to be famous anymore. This is everyone has their hooks in me, and I got to claw something back.
And it all ends with my conversation with Richard himself, if I can find him.
The podcast has found a cult following. It's held the top of the podcast charts since its debut last month. The podcast's creator, filmmaker Dan Taberski, was a friend of Simmons and a regular at his exercise classes. He set out to find Richard and understand why and how someone so attracted to the public spotlight could leave it all behind so abruptly. His mysterious disappearance has inspired fan theories, but the podcast has also received some criticism. What if Richard Simmons doesn't want to be found? Perhaps he simply wants a more private life. Is Richard Simmons really missing, or is he just missed? We spoke with him in 2005, and his genuine concern and compassion for the people he was helping came through loud and clear. We're going to listen to some of our conversation with him for the remainder of this hour. In addition to being a fitness instructor and weight loss advocate, he became a personal support system for people struggling with their weight, making as many as 50 to 100 phone calls a day.
I will most probably go back to my room and do anywhere from, I'll get most probably 50 phone calls in from letters and emails that I've received. That's what I do every day, you know.
It's amazing to me.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people out there and they come and go in the fitness and in the weight loss world. And they lie and they sell products that don't work and they break people's hearts. Mm-hmm. So I decided when I began my career 35 years ago when I opened my first exercise studio in Beverly Hills that I was going to tell people the truth because I was 268 pounds And I went on some really stupid diets, Michael. I starved. I took laxatives. I was on diet pills. Mm. I threw up. I went through all the disorders. And then when I was in college, and I hear that you love Italy, mm-hmm. because I went to college in Florence, and I go to Florence and Venice every year. And someone put a note on my car that said, "Dear Richard, you're very funny, but fat people die young." And even though I'm from New Orleans, I was 200 pounds in the eighth grade. I, you know, love Louisiana fried foods. I never thought that death was part of that equation. No one had ever said that to me. Mm-hmm. And I love life so much that I had to lose the weight. So I starved. For 2.5 months, I just drank water and ate iceberg lettuce. I lost 137 pounds, ended up in a hospital half dead. And at that point, I had to ask myself a question. Was I going to live or was I going to die? Mm-hmm. And I decided I wanted to live. And I began looking at portions of food. And I began walking, just doing anything. And I started to get healthy.
And you did this all on your own?
All on my own.
You figured this out by yourself?
Well, you know, it really isn't that difficult to figure out.
Well, I'm not sure that's true, because a lot of people have tried to lose weight, and as you say...
But they don't listen to their common sense, Michael.
Okay.
That, you know, they're watching an infomercial, lose 10 pounds over the weekend, mm-hmm. put this gadget on your stomach and you'll have a six-pack, drink this liquid, take this surgery. Mm-hmm. No, we know it doesn't work, but it's that following the weight loss rainbow. You know, everybody wants to grab onto the tail of that rainbow and lose weight. Mm-hmm. And when I began my career, I took these little pieces of construction paper and I cut out red ones, and they were the protein pieces, and I cut out yellow ones, and they were the fat, and I created something for myself called Deal a Meal. This is back in the, 70s. And I started teaching that at my studio, and I began teaching sort of light aerobics, just getting people to move. And 35 years has passed, and I've seen a lot come and go, but the truth of the matter is, the common sense formula to lose weight and get healthy is, number one, like yourself. No matter what you weigh, no matter how much money you make, no matter where you live, and no matter what car you drive, you must love yourself.
That's hard for some people.
Well, but that's the whole...
Particularly if they look in the mirror and don't like what they see.
Yeah. And then you got to watch your portions and you got to move your body. Mm-hmm. And nothing has changed since then. You know, I've watched the high carb, the low carb, the no fat, the high fat, the low fat, the no protein, the high protein. And what Americans don't realize is it's all about balance. God made 6 food groups. He's not making any more. This is it. Mm-hmm. So no matter what you eat in this town, whether it's a Bojangles biscuit or whether it's a steak, everything counts for the right portions. And all I do is just try to teach people that. And it's hard. I mean, I'm getting thousands of emails now, and I call hurricane weight gain. Thousands of people who have parked in front of the TV, who have watched Katrina, they're watching Rena, they're gaining weight, they're eating a lot of stuff that they don't normally eat, they're sitting for hours, they're not moving, and they're writing me and saying, "I just gained 12 pounds watching Hurricane Katrina." And how paradoxical that is when many of these people are starving in Louisiana and are waiting for another truck to bring them food.
Richard Simmons is our guest, and as I sit here listening to you talk and looking at you across the table, I realize how many times I have seen you on television over the years. I can't probably count them, and on very different shows where you're sometimes talking about what you're talking about here and sometimes just taking the brunt of people's jokes, et cetera. And it occurs to me that many of us, unless they go to your website or they've been to your studio or they have bought some of your products, don't really know much about Richard Simmons, except that you're an exercise guru and you wear tank tops and short shorts and you have the hair and you're fairly energetic individual. They don't know much about you.
Fairly energetic.
Well, you're being subdued this morning.
Well, I'm
you're
being
on
subdued
this
because
this
is follow the lead of your host. So when you start singing some Broadway shows, I will be along there doing it with you. Oh. But this is a very serious subject, you know.
Yeah, I know.
I travel 250 days a year. I'm here to do the Southern Woman show to teach a big exercise class tonight. But all I am is a court jester. All I am is a clown. That's all I've wanted to be.
Really?
I love making people laugh, whether it's laughing with me or at me. I love helping people.
Now, why is that? I can see people laughing with you, but why don't you mind people laughing?
Because laughter is laughter. No matter if it's with you or at you, it's still laughter. And I began in New Orleans, and My parents were very poor. Mm-hmm. And my father was a stay-at-home dad, and my mother sold Coty lipsticks in a department store on Canal Street. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand that as a child. I didn't understand why my father was at home and why my mother had to work, and it very much upset me. And I started selling pralines on the street corner. And some people laughed at me doing that. And some people
laughed. Who made them, by the way?
Leah's Southern Confection on St. Louis Street. Some people laughed that I was doing that. But I went home with money that I'd bring on my parents' bed, and I'd throw all the money in the bed and go, let's pay the rent. Let's buy some clothes. So it was important for me.
How old were you?
Eight.
Eight?
Yeah.
And there's nothing in the law down there that prevents an eight-year-old from hawking pralines on the street?
Well, we didn't call it hawking. some kids shine shoes. I just said, look, there's a long line at Brennan's. There's a long line at Antoine's. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to get in to eat for a while. I'm going to go sell them candy. Uh-huh. And, I have a wonderful life. And I love what I do, mm-hmm. but I have a very serious career. You know, I deal with death every day. I deal with people who've had strokes, heart attacks, diabetics. You know, today I have to call a lady who is a diabetic and they just cut off her leg. You know, so I have to call and cheer this woman up.
Right.
So my work is very serious, but I put the court jester hat on that's the way that I can best get my message across.
I know show business is show business, but I sometimes have seen you on Letterman. And he can be just brutal. I mean, just brutal. And you have this anger about you sometimes with him. How much of it is show business on either side of
the equation? I'm going to tell you the truth about David Letterman. I don't even know who he is. I've never met him except for on the stage. Uh-huh. When you go to the studio, they take you, put you in an elevator, and put you in your room and lock it.
Really?
Yes.
That's to protect you from the Late Show Bear.
You stay in that room and until it's time for you to come to the stage. And then when you go to the stage, you do the show, and then you leave. So I've never actually met the man. No guest have. He has a very strange relationship with people. Mm-hmm. So what you see on the show is what you get.
Right.
It's not rehearsed. There's nothing done preliminary. I just walk on and do my thing.
So are you angry?
At who?
At Dave.
No. Look, there's not too many people. If you look around with personalities, actors and actresses, there's not a lot of people who can take his banter. And there's not a lot of people who can, thrill the audience.
Does he like it when you give it back to him?
Well, I guess he did. I've done the show like 100 times.
So I guess he does. Yeah.
It's just trying to find that.
And it's freezing in there, I'm told.
It's about, I'm going to say it's about 45 degrees.
And you're in there in your outfit. You must freeze today.
In my uniform.
Excuse me. Sorry.
Batman, Superman, and Richard Simmons.
We're listening back to our 2005 conversation with Richard Simmons, inspired by the popular podcast Missing Richard Simmons, which has people asking, where's Richard? He seems to have disappeared from the public spotlight. Later in the show, we took phone calls, which illustrated just how many people he has touched over the course of his career.
Good morning. Richard, I worked with you in Forest City, North Carolina, a couple of months ago, I guess, with a woman who was morbidly obese and had lost, a couple hundred pounds, I believe, and had started her own weight loss classes. And we ambushed her, and you came in, and I've never seen so much hugging and crying in all my life. But these were happy, happy people. And I just want to applaud you for that.
You're hey, the Bill, real, I remember you. How are you?
I am doing
we
fine.
We actually went to go see a woman named Kathy Buckner.
Yeah.
And Kathy Buckner has lost 235 pounds. When I met her, she was in a wheelchair. And guess what? She's driving to Charlotte tonight to be with me.
Oh, great.
So I'm very excited.
Bill, you should join Kathy and Richard at the Southern Women's Show.
Tonight. Well, I'm at the airport on my way to Charlotte to do a documentary, or I would be.
Well, that's very sweet.
Yeah, talk about the experience at the church where they were having the classes with all the folks. And, I mean, you just went over big time there.
Well, this lady that I met, Kathy Buckner, she was in a wheelchair on oxygen. She was 340 pounds. And she was about at the end of her ropes. And I started calling her, and she started dropping weight. And then she decided she wanted to be a certified aerobic instructor. So she went to school and became aerobic instructor. And the exciting part is I went to Forest City to surprise her at a church where she teaches classes to ask her if she would like to be in my new video. So she flies out in October, and she's in my brand new disco video.
You know, all these shows like Extreme Makeover and
hate them.
I know, but you could do a show like that with a different twist.
Unfortunately, television with weight loss, it's all about competition. When they did The Big Loser,
yeah, they're doing
these
that now.
Sort of
what do you
shows,
think about that show?
I was asked to host it. I think it's disgusting.
Really?
I think the makeover shows are horrible, where they take these women and shoot so much stuff in their lips and their chest, and they all look like drag queens. I mean, you know, these. It's horrible. I was watching that show, The Swan, when it came on, where these women looked nothing like a woman anymore. They looked like plastic. I don't think that's what God wanted. I think that God wanted you to take care of yourself and look the best you can look. But these shows sometimes are double-sword because, you know, do you know how many hundreds of thousands of people write letters to Extreme Makeover?
I can only imagine.
You know,
and they are defining what beauty is.
Yeah, and then when they don't get picked, they feel worse than they did before.
They should feel better because they weren't bad enough to need the makeover.
Well, but they still feel terrible. I don't like any of those shows. I won't appear on them. I won't. You know, I don't think they're the right things for people to watch.
More of our 2005 conversation with Richard Simmons in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're listening back to our 2005 interview with the one and only Richard Simmons, fitness and weight loss guru and entertainer extraordinaire. In recent years, he's taken a step back from the public eye, inspiring the popular podcast Missing Richard Simmons. He's been called Hollywood's most accessible celebrity, not only for his numerous media appearances, but also his sincere interest in helping everyday people. We talked with him about some of the letters he receives.
You know, 50% of the letters I get are from people saying, "Dear Richard, I'm overweight, I've tried everything." And the other 50% is, "Dear Richard, can you call my mother? Can you call my wife? Can you call my husband? Can you call my 18-year-old kid?" Mm-hmm. So half of them is cold calls, which means these people don't know I'm calling. I'm just going to pick up the phone and call them.
Wow.
See if I can help.
Wow.
I love to help. I just love to help people. It's just something that my parents taught me. My parents worked for the Volunteers of America and the Junior League, and they always did charity work. So I've been doing charity work since I'm a little kid. And I just love it. I love to see people happy. I love to see success stories.
Where does that come from, do you think? This desire to make people happy? Because evidently you were not happy as a child.
Well, you know, a little bit of both. You know, I had my issues because I didn't understand my weight problem as a child, and I had no help with it. You know, your mother just said, "Oh, it's baby fat." You know, I'm 57 years old. Back then it was, "Don't worry, it's baby fat. You'll grow out of it." Well, I didn't grow out of it. You know, when I was in eighth grade, my father had to take my khaki uniforms and slit the seams and put additional fabric in. I was 200 pounds. I was the shortest.
How tall?
In eighth grade. I mean, I was a little thing. You know, I'm not a big person. And then I went to high school and ate again and went up to 268 pounds. And, you know, I never understood why people treated me so differently because I didn't think I acted like a fat person. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I had this personality and I was singing and I was joyous. But yet, you know, I didn't fit in. I was never around people my own age. My parents were much older when they had me. My mother was 39. My father was 50. So I hung around with their friends. So I had no relationship with the kids my age. All people I knew were bartenders and strippers from Bourbon Street. And you know, I just knew show business people and antique people and praline people. You know, it was a wonderful experience, except I just couldn't figure out why people treated you so differently when you were a person of girth. That was a hard problem for me.
And people do, don't they? And that's part of it. We don't admit it. We don't talk about it very much, but people do.
It's terrible. I mean, you know, I'll get letters saying, "Dear Richard, my wife's a pig. Christ almighty, I don't even want to sleep with her. You call her. Well, I call the husband and go, how dare you? Don't you ever say those things about your wife. Don't you ever say that in front of other people about your wife. What kind of a love and respect do you have for this woman? So, you know, it's very tough. It's very tough. We live in a society that thinks overweight people are stupid, sloppy, ignorant in general. You know, and that's wrong. That's the wrong assumption. And well, I'll fight the rest of my life.
Educate us a little bit, because a lot of people do think that. You're exactly right. And I guess to change your mind, you have to be enlightened, and you've been on both sides of the fence here. You've been overweight, and now you're not, and you haven't been for 35 years, and you're obviously in shape, and you obviously eat right, and you help people every day.
Every day.
Do this. I mean, I have something here. You talked to a guy named Greg Overholtzer, who at the top of his weight was 646 pounds. I can't even fathom that, but he was having trouble fitting into things like seats, and he's now lost, with your help, 295 pounds.
Now it's 320.
And wow.
And he's here in Charlotte. I'll see him tonight.
So he's hovering around 320 pounds.
Yes.
Still overweight, but he's made remarkable
progress. Well, he got a job, and he has self-respect and self-esteem. So
help me to understand how people get to 646 pounds, how people like Richard Simmons at the age of 18 was 200 and what did you say you
68.
Were? 68 pounds. How does that happen?
Well, easily. You just get depressed and someone will say something negative to you and then you'll turn to food. And then it's your birthday and you're happy and you'll turn to food. And then as you keep eating and getting more depressed, you start to build a wall around you. And it's a comfort wall, mm-hmm. and it's a wall that you don't let people in. And then, you know, every time I talk to a housebound person, Michael, yesterday I talked to an 800-pound man, an 1,100-pound man, a 1,000-pound woman who is just in bed. They go to the bathroom in bed. Someone cleans it up. They bring food to them. They take a sponge bath in bed. It's very, very tragic. You know, you don't see these people because they're housebound, and I go and fly and see them and try to get them in a rehab center.
So it's a psychological problem and an addiction problem.
And it is, but then it becomes a medical and physical problem, right. You know.
And we don't treat it like that. We treat it like somebody's lazy.
We treat it like leprosy.
And,
uh-huh. We treat it like they're lepers, you know. Oh, they're fat. They won't hear us. Oh, they're fat. They won't feel that. Oh, they're fat.
And I would think, since you believe, and I think you're right about this, obviously, that the key to this is diet and exercise.
It's got to be a combination. You know, you can't just, everybody wants to do one or the other. Well, most people hate to exercise.
Yeah.
Hate it. And that's why God made me, so I could be cute and effervescent and get real music and get them feeling good. I mean, that's what I live for. I live for my next class. But you got to do the food, too.
Yeah. But when you're talking about somebody who's 18, and I don't know how tall you were at 18, but 18 years old and 268 pounds, or this fellow here who was 646 pounds, they're not going to be able to do very much in terms of exercise. Many of them can't walk across the room.
Well, so I do videos for people.
How do you start?
Well, how do you start?
Where do you start?
You have to start by getting a complete physical. And usually, you know, I try to help them find a doctor, because many doctors do not want to have a patient that is 600 pounds. They just don't want it. It's very, you know, it's not fashionable to be overweight and obese. And so it's sometimes very difficult to find people to help. I do videos for people in chairs called Sit Tight, where they can do everything from a chair. But the first thing I try to do is I try to find out what their health is like. You know, are they diabetic? Is their blood pressure high? What's their cholesterol like? What are their triglycerides? And then I work with the doctor to see what's best for this person. But they can't do it alone. And there's very few rehab centers in the United States. And I'm attached to all of them. So I can call Far Rockaway, New York at Brookhaven Rehab and say, I have a 700-pound woman here. You got to go come get her and bring her there. You just got to for me. Mm-hmm. You just got to do this for me. And then I go and I visit these rehab centers and I keep pumping them with information, pumping them with motivation to say, look, you've lost 100 pounds. Now we're going to work on the next 50. Yeah. And you're going to get out of here. You're going to get off welfare and SSI disability. You're going to get a job and you're going to have a life.
And isn't that part of it seems to me that you don't become 646 pounds overnight. It took a long time to get there. So it's going to take a long time to get to 198 pounds from 646 pounds, if ever. So how do you keep them? That's got to be
inspired.
Yeah, inspired.
My phone calls, when they see me on television, when they watch my infomercials.
And you don't get paid for this part of your job, do you?
No. No, but I've done okay.
I know.
I've done okay. And I don't know. I just get up every morning and go, okay, God, what do you want me to do today? You just lead me and tell me what you want me to do. How many calls you want me to make? How many people you want me to see? What hospitals will I go to teach classes? You know, will I see a housebound person? Mm-hmm. I believe very much in prayer, so I pray after all of my classes.
Collectively or just by yourself?
No, collectively. With everybody in the room. Mm-hmm. Whether I'm doing a cruise to lose, where I'm taking 400 overweight people on a cruise of eating healthy and exercising, whether I'm in a city doing an exercise class, no matter where I am, I just try to make people feel better than before they met me.
Do you ever get tired? I mean, 250 nights on the road, 250 days and nights on the road, that's a lot. I mean, that is two-thirds of the year or more.
Yes.
And it has to take a toll on where you eat, what you eat, how can you exercise, how much you can exercise, because you're in a strange place and you haven't got your comfort zone around you, and you can't really control your life as well as you could if you stayed in one place.
But I've learned to do that. You know, I've learned to adapt no matter where I am to what food, what hotel I'm in. It doesn't matter. That stuff doesn't matter to me anymore. What matters to me is my mission. And my mission is for people to move their minds in the right direction, to move their fork in the right direction, and to move their body in the right direction. And while I see all these other people who have come on TV with products that are wrong, I feel very angry, because why should we lie to these people to make a buck?
Do you think they're doing it intelligently? Intentionally?
Yes.
Because I know when that you're not a fan.
When you're selling a diet pill, and on the air, and you're making all of these false claims, and then they send in their $125.
But you're not,
I think you should be ashamed of
yourself.
You're
not a fan of the Atkins diet, are you?
I'm not a fan of diets.
Okay.
If you take the word diet and break it up in syllables, the first syllable is die. I am in favor of a
die from what you eat.
Yeah. I'm in favor of a live it, something you have to live by every day, nothing you have to die by every day.
Okay.
I don't believe in mixing and excluding food groups. I think all food groups are there for a person, for a purpose. I went to the grocery store the other night, and I said, I'm going to go to all the areas that sell starches. Okay? Do you know that 75% of the store is starches? 75.
I have no doubt.
Where they go to the produce for the pumpkins and the potatoes and the yams and the corn and the peas, where they go to the crackers, the potato chips, the cookies, the bakery. I mean, no matter the rice, the frozen stuff, no matter where you go, the food industry has made us carb-aholic. We always seem to grab for a carb or something sweet.
It's comfort food. It's very good.
No, I believe in getting up in the morning and having, you know, a good solid breakfast, watching your portions, eating salads, not eating dinner too. I mean, nothing, it's new.
What do you eat? What did you have for breakfast this morning?
I had a Bojangle biscuit.
Really?
Yes, I did.
Starch.
No, but I mean, I'm in the South. I've been to Charlotte many times.
And they're good, aren't they?
And I'll have a biscuit and a little orange juice, because I don't normally have that at home. You know, in New Orleans, we never had biscuits. It wasn't a biscuit
city.
It was French bread and the beignet donuts and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
No, I eat real food, but, you know, I eat 1,800 calories a day and 35 grams of fat. When that is inside of me, then I shut the trough.
Explain to me what that means, 1,800 calories, 35 grams of fat. What is that like? What do you eat?
I eat salads, lots of salads. I eat chicken, fish. I eat vegetables.
Do you have dessert?
You know, it's usually on Saturday night, but I have very serious asthma, so I have to watch very carefully any kind of dairy in the evening.
Really?
So I was born, you know, New Orleans, damp, humid, molding.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the hospital at least 4 to 5 days a week with my asthma. I had very bad, very bad asthma.
Was it hard to adopt this regimen, this food intake regimen? Obviously, you're probably used to it now, but was it difficult?
No, I just cut down, Michael. I eat everything that you would eat. Now, you're a little teeny thing, and most probably you can eat and not gain weight. But, you know, I can look at an ad, a Sara Lee ad in Good Housekeeping, and lick it and gain 2 pounds. So, I mean, I gain weight very quick. That's why I just watch my portions. Mm-hmm. You know, in the hotel I'm staying in last night, I decided to, you know, do some writing. And there was a snack. You know, there's this little snack thing there. I wanted every one of those snacks. It happened to be 8:30 at night. And I didn't touch any of them. Because where was I going to – I wasn't going to burn those calories. They were going to sit there. And that would have not made me very happy after I finished.
So where does the willpower come from? Where does that – that takes a lot willpower.
Loving me and never wanting to be obese again.
That's Richard Simmons, recorded in 2005. Simmons appears to have stepped out of the public spotlight, and his disappearance has inspired a new podcast, Missing Richard Simmons. My full interview with him, which includes us singing together, is on our website along with photos from his visit. Please don't find it at wfae.org/charlottetalks.